the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we offer the last in a three-part series of our favorite shows from 2005. Next week we return with the first in our new season of interviews and commentaries. During the week of November 11th, we aired an interview with Jared Diamond in which we discussed his research on how societies have developed, and especially why they have failed. Diamond spoke with Talking History's Fred Nielsen. And we concluded our special series of readings from the recollections of field hospital service during the War of Secession, the unpublished reminiscences of T.V. Brown. We pick it up with my weekly segment, This Week in the News, for November 11th, 2005. The death of Emmett Till stalks the American soul 50 years after the Chicago youngster's mutilated body was discovered in the Tallahatchie River. Till, at age 14, was abducted in August of 1955 from his uncle's Mississippi home after he supposedly whistled at a white store clerk. He was beaten and shot, and his body weighted down before it was thrown into the river. But Till's killing did not happen in isolation. It was one of many in a period of American history known for its violence against African Americans that began soon after the Civil War and lasted well into the 20th century. That tale is now being told at the Chicago Historical Society in its exhibition, Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America. Lynching was a means of social control, according to Lonnie Bunch, president of the Chicago Historical Society. By one conservative estimate, at least 1,000 people were lynched in America. It's a story we should remember. And our troops in Iraq are now receiving training in history as well as military maneuvers. The Archaeological Institute of America has announced a new educational program that will teach soldiers headed for the Middle East the history and cultural heritage of the region they will be entering. The troops currently being sent to the Middle East have to deal with a culture that many of them have never studied, commented Brian Rose, AIA First Vice President. Often they're called upon to patrol archaeological sites and museums, and this requires a deeper understanding of that culture. Archaeologists will provide the military with materials covering the civilizations of ancient Mesopotamia and Afghanistan, including general overviews of the sites and archaeological discoveries in those areas. When we return, Fred Nielsen explores why societies collapse with Jared Diamond, and we conclude our series of readings from T.V. Brown's Recollections of Field Hospital Service during the War of Secession. This is Talking History. The latest book by our guest this week could easily be seen as a lengthy chronicle of failure. But he argues that it really is an optimistic book. Talking History's Fred Nielsen explores that and other matters with Jared Diamond.
In his previous book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, my guest Jared Diamond explored how societies developed and why Western civilizations came to dominate much of the world. A work of wide-ranging scholarship, the book became a bestseller and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. In his latest book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, Diamond examines the other side of the coin, why past civilizations, often by their own actions, have fallen into ruin. Jared Diamond is a professor of geography at UCLA. Mr. Diamond, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Your previous book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, sought to explain why certain societies advanced further than others. And a large part of that answer had to do with accidents of geography. Some areas had more plants and animals that could be domesticated than others, for example. Some readers of that book charged that you were a geographical determinist. Your new book, Collapse, seems, at least as I read it, to refute that claim. Societies make choices that can have momentous consequences.
The difference between the two books in that respect is that in the case of Guns, Germs, and Steel, where I was concerned with the rise of complex societies over the last 13,000 years, that was severely constrained by, as you say, the wild plants and animals available for domestication, because a prerequisite to the development of complex political systems and technology and writing was farming societies, but those could arise only where there were wild plants and animals suitable for domestication, such as wheat and cows and sheep. In California, where I come from, it's now a center of North American agriculture, but there were no domesticable wild plants and animals. In the new book about why societies succeeded or failed at solving their environmental problems, there society's choices play a much bigger role because faced with the same problems such as incipient deforestation, some societies have solved the problems and some have failed to do so.
One of the societies that fails, you call it one of the purest examples of ecological suicide, is Easter Island, an isolated island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's the site of enormous and mysterious stone statues. That island was once forested and now the trees are all but gone. What happened?
Briefly, they were cut down. It took 850 years to cut them down. When Europeans came to Easter Island for the first time in 1722, the Europeans were stunned to see a treeless landscape, the only treeless island in Polynesia, and yet standing there were these giant stone statues of up to 90 tons, somehow transported and erected by people without carts or draft animals, and obviously it took wood for sleds or rollers or levers to do this, but the island had no trees, so what happened? And the explanation that's come out from archaeological studies in the last couple of decades is that the island, when settled by Polynesians, was covered by a forest that included the world's biggest palm tree, and gradually the islanders cut down the trees for clearance for gardens and canoes and fuel and construction and levers for the statues. They kept going until around 1650. All the trees were chopped down, at which point the island society collapsed in an epidemic of cannibalism. And so this is as close, as you say, that we get to a purely ecological collapse, because with the remoteness of Easter Island, there were no enemies or friends to complicate the picture. It was just what the islanders themselves did, hammering away at their essential resources.
There's a general question that haunts your book. How can societies fail to see dangers that in retrospect appear so obvious? Or in the form in which you ask it about Easter Island, what were they thinking when they cut down that last tree?
Yeah, my students at UCLA, to whom I've taught an undergraduate course on the material of the book, asked me that question. What did the Easter Islander who cut down the last tree? What was he thinking? What did he say as he was cutting down the last tree? And my students have said things such as, maybe he was thinking, never fear, technology will solve our problems and find us a substitute for wood. Or, this is my tree and my land, private property rights, keep the big government of the chiefs off my back. That gives you the flavor of it. In fact, the reasons why societies make fatal mistakes, they're complicated. They're really complicated. And it's going on today. If there are still people and a complex society left 70 years from now, I'm sure they're going to look back at the year 2005 and say, what on earth were those Americans and Europeans and Japanese thinking of when they were doing such obviously dumb things as exhausting their energy reserves and destroying their fisheries and letting soil erode into the ocean and running across these water problems and overpumping the Oglala Aquifer? But the same questions arise for the Easter Islanders and Maya and past societies.
Was part of the problem that the process takes so long, what, 800 years or so to chop the trees down? You use the phrase at one point in the book, landscape amnesia. If the changes come slowly, you tend to forget what was once there.
You're right. That is one of the reasons that people make what in retrospect seem to be dumb mistakes. Often the change is very slow. For example, nowadays, why did it take 30 years before every knowledgeable scientist concerned with climate became convinced of the reality of global warming and climate change? And 30 years ago, it wasn't stupid that we were arguing about it. It's that climate didn't inexorably get warmer 1 degree each year, in which case in 5 years it would have been clear. Instead, it was a slow change that 1 year was warmer, then warm again, then colder, colder, warm, up and down. So it took several decades to see the trend. And similarly, the deforestation of Easter Island took 850 years. It wasn't as if in 5 years they cut down all except one tree, and then in the fifth year they cut down the last tree, and how stupid that was.
We've talked about a long, slow collapse. Let's turn to a much quicker one. The Norse come to North America well before Columbus. They don't stay very long. They don't last as long as the Spanish. What happened to them?
The Norse who came to North America, and remember, this is the real first European settlement of the New World 492 years before Columbus. The Norse from Norway, Vikings, who had colonized Iceland and then Greenland. From Greenland, they sailed further west and they discovered the New World and they set up a base camp on Newfoundland. And from there, they explored the Gulf of St. Lawrence. But they abandoned their camp within 10 years. And the reason was the teeming populations of Native Americans, American Indians, with whom the Norse immediately got off onto bad terms. The Norse saw that they were outnumbered, and it was a long ship journey from Greenland where there weren't that many Norse anyway. So it was Native Americans plus the long supply route that caused the failure of that first brief European attempt to settle the New World.
The Norse who come to North America come first from Greenland. That's their launching pad, at least. And they're there for several hundred years. They get off to a reasonably good start there. But the things that look like advantages at first, a reasonable climate, open sea lanes, desirable exports, Europeans want the things that they can produce, all turn against them in the end. What kinds of misjudgments do the Norse make there?
There again, there are deep lessons. The Norse in Greenland lasted for 450 years, and that's longer than North American society. European society has lasted in the New World. The Norse, as you say, started out in Greenland, building up a daring society based on cows, sheep, and goats. They traded with Norway. They were the most remote outpost of Christian Europe. They built a cathedral, churches. There were 6,000 of them. They wrote Latin and Old Norse. And their strength in maintaining themselves so far from Europe was social cohesion and a Christian identity. They viewed themselves as Europeans in this remote outpost. They cooperated in hunting and in sealing and in fishing and in the hay harvest. And tragically, it was those values that had been the source of their strength that ultimately undid them, because when it got colder and then when the Inuit, the Eskimos, invaded Greenland, the Norse, as good European Christians, despised the pagan Inuit, immediately began to try to kill them, which was not a good idea because the Norse by then didn't have steel swords or armor. And they refused to learn from these Inuit that they despised and called wretches, which was again a bad idea because the Inuit had a much more successful hunting and fishing and whaling technology than the Norse. So what had been the strength of the Norse, their cohesion as European Christians, ultimately caused them to refuse to learn from the Inuit, with the result that all the Norse ended up dead and the Inuit inherited Greenland and they're still there today.
That seems like an awfully hard lesson to learn, though. In effect, what the moral seems to be is that you have to let go of part of your identity in order to survive. The Norse Greenlanders preferred, I think, as you put it, to die as they were rather than to live as someone else.
It is a hard lesson to learn. It's always a hard lesson for a society to reappraise what have been its core values that have served it well, and those values may no longer be suitable to change circumstances. That's a problem we face today in the United States. Two traditional values of the United States have been what we now pejoratively call consumerism, but throughout American history, the reason we're the richest country in the world today is that we had the endless frontier, unlimited resources, hence unlimited exploitation, and that worked okay as long as the resources were in effect unlimited compared to our population. But now that we are gradually depleting resources in the United States and in the world, our core value of consumerism doesn't make sense anymore. And the other value that's now getting us into trouble is our isolationism. Again, for centuries, we were really protected by the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and we didn't have to become engaged chronically with overseas countries. But now, particularly since September 11th, we know that the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean don't protect us. We've got to get engaged on a long-term basis with overseas countries, and we can't simply wait for one or two overseas countries to collapse in a crisis and then we throw in 150,000 troops and $280 billion to seek short-term military solutions. For one or two countries, we've done it, but we can't do it for the next 25 countries waiting to collapse. So that's a painful appraisal ahead of us.
There's a map in your book that shows, very interesting, world political trouble spots and environmental trouble spots, that the maps are virtually identifying the same places.
I've had readers, in fact, who wondered whether that page was a printer's error. You're correct that the page has two maps, and the top map is labeled something like political trouble spots of the world, and the bottom map is labeled environmentally ravaged parts of the world. And they denote 15 countries, and the black spots on the map, the 15 countries are identical in both maps, but that's not a printer's error. It makes a point. The geopolitical trouble spots in the world today are places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Philippines, Nepal, Haiti, but the environmentally ravaged trouble spots with overpopulation in relation to their resources are Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Haiti, Nepal, Philippines, Indonesia. That's cause and effect. Countries that are starting to collapse because of environmental and population problems tend to blow up in civil wars or in mass emigrations or in support of terrorists when people get desperate and there's nothing better to do.
Is it possible to generalize about why societies collapse?
Yes, it's possible to generalize. The first generalization would be it's very complicated and resist generalization. But then the next three generalizations would be that in many past collapses, environmental and population problems have played a major role, not in all, but in many of them. And therefore, one can generalize today because there are far more of us and we've got bulldozers and more potent technology than existed in the past. Today, we'd better be serious about the threats from environmental population problems. And then I think the other two generalizations are, first of all, that where you have the elite of a society insulating itself from the consequences of their actions because, say, they are still being able to live well while the rest of society is starving, that's a blueprint for trouble. And the other blueprint for trouble is a society that, like the Greenland Norse, refuses to reappraise its core values.
Your book and most of our conversation so far has been focusing on failure, and yet it comes as a bit of a surprise to a reader of your book when, late in the book, you write that you're really writing an optimistic work here, and you end up by calling yourself a cautious optimist. What's the source of your optimism?
I would have to defend my book from the outset because I know that books on gloom and doom that end in pessimism, who wants to read more pessimism? And therefore, I'm careful to say in the introduction, this book will talk about failed societies, and so you may think that this is going to be pessimistic, but don't get depressed because I'm also going to talk about the successes. And the book does look at societies that succeeded in solving environmental problems that did in other societies. And I end up the book on a cautiously optimistic note because we've got something big going in our favor today that no past society had, and that is the media, television, radio, newspapers, books that let us learn from the problems of remote societies. So we have the opportunity to learn from the mistakes of distant societies. Plus today we've got archaeologists to tell us about the mistakes of past societies. Whereas the Maya and the Anasazi and the Greenland Norse and the Easter Islanders, they had no way of knowing about remote societies having the same problems at the same time, nor do they have archaeologists to tell them about past societies that have succumbed. And that's the main reason why I haven't already committed suicide and why I'm cautiously optimistic.
Well, thank goodness for that. Professor Diamond, thanks so much for visiting with us.
You are welcome. It's a pleasure.
I've been talking with Jared Diamond, the author of Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed.
Over the past few weeks, we've aired excerpts from the unpublished manuscript, Recollections of Field Hospital Service During the War of Secession, by T.V. Brown. For those of you just joining us, Theodore Brown was a German immigrant who joined the U.S. Union Army and became a hospital steward early in the Civil War. He wrote his recollections in the 1890s after 3 decades of military service. In the previous episode, Brown recalled the suffering of hungry, exhausted men in the depths of the frigid winter of December 1863. Led by General W.W. Averill, the men marched to Salem, Virginia, in a daring raid to destroy the tracks of the Virginia and Tennessee Railroad. In this, our final episode, Brown, driven by cold, hunger, and fatigue, decides to find food. David Jones, our reader for the series, picks up the story.
Shortly before dusk on the 24th of December, when we were within about 50 miles of Beverly and pursuit at about an end, General Averill concluded to make camp for the night. This did not meet the approval of all of his starving men, who were quietly preparing, almost to a man, to continue their march on their own account until they should find food. Seeing this, the general quickly established a picket line, with strict orders to allow no one to leave camp without a pass. Hoping that the recollection of the services I had rendered him at the crossing of the Greenbrier River would dispose the general to grant me a favor in return, I presented myself to him. "General," I said, "I know that I am not worse off than nearly all of the others, but I have had nothing to eat for 5 days and nights, and beg you to let me keep on until I can find something to eat." "Certainly," answered the general, and pulling out his notebook, he wrote me the coveted pass. I now kept my unwilling mule on a slow trot by incessantly plying him with the spurs, and about 11 o'clock, 5 long hours after leaving the command, I was rejoiced to reach the first sign of human habitation, a poor log cabin, whose one room was still brightly lit up. Knocking at the door of the cabin, it was opened by an old woman. "Have you anything to eat in the house?" I asked. "I have not. But there is some corn meal, and if you will wait, I can make you a corn dodger," answered the woman. "I'll wait," said I. In a few minutes the dough was prepared, placed in a Dutch oven, and the latter on the abundant live coals in the open fireplace. Soon the baking mass began to emit a bread smell which almost set me wild, and after waiting as long as I could endure the cravings of hunger, increased twofold by the smell which may have been 15 minutes, certainly not more, I asked, "Is it done yet?" "Not yet," was the answer. "Take it out," I ordered. The loaf was not half-baked and heavy as lead, but I swallowed it in less than 10 minutes, and giving the woman 25 cents, I mounted my mule and continued my journey until about 2 a.m., when I reached a hamlet 10 miles from Beverly. And knocking at the door of the first house, I came to until I was admitted, and I should not have hesitated a moment to force a night's lodging at the muzzle of my revolver, and at once went to bed and dreamed. Dreamed I was riding up mountains, down mountains, through rivers, and thus I dreamed every night for weeks, until I began to fear that the spectre of the raid would haunt my sleep during the remainder of my life. I woke in time to join the family at the noonday meal, and General Averill making his appearance at the head of his command. I fell in behind his staff, and we made a triumphal entry into Beverly about 4 o'clock that Christmas Day. To sum up, we had, by the most direct route, marched from New Creek, West Virginia, to Salem, Virginia, had at that point destroyed the railroad connecting Lee's and Longstreet's armies, as well as an immense amount of supplies for the Confederate armies, and had then returned to Beverly, West Virginia, by a most circuitous route to avoid being intercepted by the enemy. We had swam swollen rivers encumbered with drifting ice, had been 8 days and nights continuously in the saddle, 2 days and nights during which we were compelled to lead our own horses on account of the slippery condition of the frozen roads, had been obliged to drag along the 12 pieces of cannon and caissons, had been entirely without food during the last 5 days and nights. Most of the officers and men had their feet more or less frozen, and many of these had to walk day and night as their horses had given out. Though we were frequently fired upon from ambush by bushwhackers, none of our men were killed or wounded, so far as I am aware, and we had no brush of any kind with the enemy. But few of the command fell into the hands of the Confederates. After our return, our chief and constant amusements were eating and sleeping for about a week. Then we were ready, but not anxious, for more such experiences. If any of my readers have suffered hardships equal to those just narrated during that or any other war, I should be glad to hear from them. But all is well that ends well, and to use Byron's words, fare you well, and if forever, then forever fare you well.
You've been listening to David Jones, a graduate student in the theater program at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, reading from T.V. Brown's Recollections of Field Hospital Service during the War of Secession. Our thanks to the Clendenning Library of the University of Kansas Medical Center for their permission to use this unpublished manuscript. If you missed any of the previous segments in this series, or if you want to hear the series again, you can find them at oah.org. Click on Talking History and on our shows, which aired from September 19th through October 31st. To find out more about the Clendenning Library, go to clendenning.kumc.edu. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.